Good evening and welcome to Talking Fletch. Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clutch. This is Marianne Russo. I'd like to acknowledge my co-moderator tonight, Chuck Wally, who will be holding down the fort on our Twitter tweet chat, where you can go and interact while you listen to the interview. In the United States, the DSM is the primary system used by psychiatrists to classify and diagnose mental disorders in adults and children. It is published by the American Psychiatric Association, and it cannot be overstated how important and influential it is. It is the book by which clinicians and doctors are trained, insurance is reimbursed, school accommodations are approved, legislation is passed, justice is executed, and research is guided. So it's very important, and defining mental illness is a daunting task. If the threshold is too low, there's a risk of being accused of medicalizing many normalcies, and if it's set too high, there's a risk of missing people, and for this interview specifically, children, who are in danger and need of help. So I am very honored tonight to have Dr. Alan Francis, the chair of the DSM-IV Task Force and the Department of Psychiatry at Duke University. Welcome, Dr. Francis.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, I'm thrilled you're here. I think it's important that parents understand the DSM and also understand the changes as it's going to pertain to their children. It would literally take hours for us to go into the details of all of the upcoming proposed changes to the manual. So tonight we're going to primarily be discussing the proposed addition of temperament dysregulation disorder with dysphoria and juvenile bipolar disorder. But I did want to start, Dr. Francis, just very, very briefly, if you could just tell us how the selection of diagnostic criteria is done and by whom.
Well, as you mentioned, the American Psychiatric Association is responsible for developing the manual, and they appoint a chair, and he appoints a bunch of work groups in different areas of psychiatry, and each work group will have anywhere between about 5 and 15 members who are expert in that particular area. And then they'll meet, they'll discuss on the telephone, they'll read the literature, and they will consider possible changes in the system. And eventually, once a decision is made, it's meant to be field tested to try to determine what its impact will be. And finally, it's approved and published.
So, you know, as I said, this has got to be a daunting task, especially when it comes to children who, you know, present so differently. So why don't we start with juvenile bipolar disorder? Because right now the criteria being used basically to diagnose is adult criteria. And this is, shown to be problematic because, you know, now, as, you know, many parents see and the clinicians see, children clearly present differently. They have more rapid cycling, chronic irritability, and less, it's not as episodic. So, some even say that bipolar now is rare and that, in fact, it's a different disorder altogether that better describes these kids. What are the upcoming changes that are going to be made or proposed to be made for the bipolar diagnosis, and how will it impact these kids?
Well, I think it's useful to go back historically. Up until about 20 years ago, bipolar disorder in children was considered to be vanishingly rare, because children generally don't have cycles of going up at times and being depressed at others. So this was considered a very rare disorder. Some of the leaders in child psychiatry suggested that perhaps childhood bipolar disorder is quite different than adult bipolar disorder, and that in kids maybe there aren't the cycles. Maybe it would be expressed by irritability, anger, temper tantrums, conduct problems, oppositional behavior, and that this would be a precursor to bipolar disorder, and that there should be different criteria for diagnosing bipolar in kids since it's developmentally different. This was actually suggested for DSM-IV, and we rejected the suggestion. And we rejected it because there was so little evidence to confirm it, and we set a very high standard for introducing changes. So without a very substantial proof of the concept, we were unwilling to say that bipolar disorder in children would be that much different, and not episodic and more sort of anger and irritability than the high episodes in adults. So we rejected the proposal. This didn't really impact the field very much. The fact that we rejected it didn't change what ultimately happened, which was that some very influential people in child psychiatry promoting this idea very aggressively, and then drug companies advertising it very aggressively, changed dramatically the practice habits of child psychiatrists and pediatricians in America. Not in conformity to DSM-IV, really not at all what we intended, but currently very large number of children are diagnosed as having bipolar disorder based on chronic, constant irritability, anger, school problems with conduct, getting in trouble with the law, all sorts of behaviors that are very difficult for parents to manage are now being covered under the rubric of bipolar disorder and very often being treated with antipsychotic medication or mood stabilizing medication. So the rates of bipolar disorder, which were very, very low in children, has skyrocketed. They've increased more than 40-fold in the last 20 years, not because of DSM-IV, but because of the practice habits of psychiatrists and pediatricians influenced by these thought leaders, influenced by the advertising, and also influenced by the fact that there are lots of kids who have terrible problems, and parents and teachers are just at a loss to figure out what to do about them. And putting these kids under the rubric of bipolar disorder seems to be a solution because there are treatments for bipolar disorder.
Right. So there were treatments for it, but what, you know, the parents are finding is that even, you know, the use of the psychotropic medications really isn't helping the mood for a lot of these children. And I think, you know, that leads me to think about the comorbidity and the confusion that parents are having, whether it is comorbidity or whether this is a dimensional disorder. With, you know, bipolar being so...
Yeah, I think what's happened is that if we have a condition in a kid that's really tough to understand, a kid who's causing a lot of misery around him, maybe feeling miserable, but also very, very difficult to manage, everyone wants to have an answer because it's, a situation just cries out for some solution. And there was a hope that this new concept of bipolar disorder would be that solution, that if these kids had bipolar disorder, then we have a treatment for that. And we understand a lot about bipolar disorder. And maybe then we could solve the problem. However, it turns out that the treatment for bipolar disorders are often inappropriate in these other situations. And even if they are helpful symptomatically, they cause so many problems themselves that it's sometimes not clear whether it's worth it. So that the antipsychotic medications, which are now being used enormously in America, 5% of all prescriptions written in America are now for antipsychotic medications. All prescriptions, not just psychiatry, all prescriptions. And it's a $10 billion industry. These medications cause tremendous weight gain so that the average teenager who weighs 110 pounds... being on the medication for 12 weeks will result in a pound a week weight gain. So 12 weeks later, that kid will weigh 122 pounds. And some of the medications even more, either a pound and a half a week. We already have a childhood obesity epidemic, and the risks of obesity are enormous. So that the use of antipsychotic medications to treat irritability and aggressive behavior in kids is sometimes necessary. It's a case-by-case decision. Sometimes necessary. But we should realize that not all of these kids are going to go on to have bipolar disorder. They won't need the medicine for a lifetime. They may only need it for a short period of time. That the medicine has substantial risks, and it's always a risk-benefit analysis in each kid whether it makes sense to be using it. And certainly, I think we should realize that aggressive behavior, irritable behavior, oppositional behavior is more a symptom that can be caused by many, many different things, that it's not necessarily bipolar disorder, and all too frequently now it's being classified as such, treated as such, and with the implication it's a lifetime illness, because bipolar disorder is usually a lifetime diagnosis, whereas kids are remarkably changeable. It's very hard in general to do psychiatric diagnosis in kids because the track record is so brief, because of developmental factors, because of all the family and school stressors they may be experiencing, so that we shouldn't be jumping to this very sort of serious, long-term, potentially dangerous diagnosis and treatment for bipolar disorder for kids who may have problems of conduct and irritability that are much more related to other things or likely to be much more short-term.
Right, and you know, as many of the parents find, that the symptoms and the presentations, they change, which is different than adults. So it's very difficult to unravel actually what you have. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, bipolar is one of the disorders that seems to have a lot of comorbidity. And I think that leads to a lot of confusion, not only in what the actual diagnosis is, but in what direction the treatment should go.
That's a great point, Mary.
You know, so it's very difficult because, you know, you have ADD, you have ODD, you have conduct disorder. Do you think that these are all standalone diagnoses that are comorbid with these children, or do you think that it's possible that this is a dimensional type of disorder where it's like a spectrum, not unlike autism where there's different presentations, different levels of impairment? It just seems that there's just so much comorbidity.
Well, I think the real problem is that we had this tremendous, I would call it false epidemic of bipolar disorder, with it being diagnosed liberally across the board based on very flimsy evidence with very little research to support it. So my sense is that there's a great overdiagnosis of bipolar disorder as a way of trying to provide help for kids who would probably be better classified as having conduct disorder, or oppositional disorder, or attention deficit disorder, or one of these other things. I don't think that in most instances the kids have both disorders. I think the diagnosis of bipolar is very often just incorrect, and that the other diagnosis probably makes more sense. But the reason for wanting to call them bipolar has been because there's a treatment for it, where there is not a clear-cut effective treatment for conduct disorder or for oppositional defiant disorder. The tendency is to try to, you know, have a hammer to try to find the nail for it. And I think in this case, what that's led to is a great overdiagnosis of bipolar disorder, and in most instances, probably an incorrect diagnosis.
So how then do we rectify this problem? Because there are so many, you know, as I said, you know, the criteria that's in the DSM-4 is very different than proposed criteria. And the, you know, the chronic irritability, the depressed states in between, you know, none of these are really addressed. I mean, there are a lot of omissions, you know, that parents see, because I'm going to speak for the parents. I'll be bold enough to speak to the parents, that, you know, there are a lot of things that the parents are seeing that are not defined in the DSM-4 or the proposed DSM-5. Like, you know, there's a lot of sleep disturbances in the majority of these kids. There's, you know, bedwetting, there's low frustration tolerance, there's severe separation anxiety, and, you know, these kids are always hot. There's, you know, thermoregulatory issues. So it seems, you know, I sit and I think, well, if you put too much criteria in the diagnosis, that would just encompass too many people. So how do you add these symptoms that the parents are seeing that could probably help define which group they should go into? How do you balance that out?
Yeah, I think you're pointing out a crucial problem, that the diagnostic system for kids, particularly, has to be seen as tentative, that children present in ways that are very influenced by their developmental stage, by their environment, by their circumstances in life, and that I think making a diagnosis in a child is a much more tentative thing than making a diagnosis in a 50-year-old, where you have a long track record and you can be more confident that the past is going to be a predictor of the future. When you have a very short past to go on in a situation that's inherently changeable because kids change so much just on the developmental track, I think it should be a matter of great caution before making definitive diagnoses. And I think you often do see fairly complex mixtures of symptoms that may not fit any of the categories specifically in the book. And often I think the treatments should be geared more to symptoms than to any idea that we're going to have a clear-cut diagnosis that's going to have a clear-cut answer. So I guess what I would counsel is caution. I think that the it would be nice if there were clear right answers and we could say, well, this kid has this problem and this is the prognosis, and if we do this treatment, we'll get this good result. But I don't really think that the state of the art comes anywhere near achieving that degree of certainty or prescriptive clarity. And I think that if you're a parent, right, you just have to sort of be patient and treat things as they are without expecting that there'll be a magic diagnosis or a magic treatment that's going to make everything all better.
Right. And, you know, we say that all the time here on the Coffee Clutch, that, you know, if you're, you know, looking for that perfect cure, you know, you may have a very long road ahead of you because, you know, right now there are no cures. And the best we can do is treat the symptoms. And I'm so glad you said that because, you know, the DSM is a very necessary, you know, manual, obviously. But, you know, you don't treat the label, you treat the symptoms. And, you know, I think also it's very difficult, you know, for the children to be diagnosed because, you know, it's not coming from the child, really, because a lot of them are too young to really know what they're feeling. So often it's, you know, firsthand information coming from a parent, and a lot of that can be very, you know, it could be what they perceive the situation to be rather than what it is. So, you know, it's very hard when it comes to
I generally like the idea of great caution in diagnosis and in treatment planning, and especially, as we just said, for kids and teenagers. And one way of looking at this is a stepped approach, that you don't necessarily make the diagnosis the first time the clinician sees the kid, that there's a period of watchful waiting to see how things evolve. I think it's very useful to provide psychotherapy before medication, whenever that's possible and may be helpful, and to see medication as the last resort in situations where there's really no other choice, it's absolutely necessary, and to try to see it whenever possible as a time-limited intervention, not necessarily one that's going to be for years or for a lifetime, and to constantly be reevaluating the diagnosis as things change over time. Now, I don't want parents to get the idea that I'm recommending they go out and stop the medication, or that anything that I say here necessarily applies to their kid, because, you know, obviously every kid's different and every situation has its own particularities, and nothing I say here generally can be taken to be gospel when it comes to your child and what you should do next. I think that the thing I'm trying to make people aware of is the fact that there's been this tremendous increase in the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in kids, a tremendous increase in the use of antipsychotic and mood-stabilizing medications in kids, and that probably that's gone overboard. But that doesn't mean it's gone overboard for any individual's own kid, and that before doing anything, there should be, you know, recommendations from doctors. I believe greatly in second opinions, maybe third opinions, and sometimes fourth opinions, to try to get as much information as possible about the different ways of looking at the situation before making a decision, and realizing that there's inherently going to be a great deal of uncertainty. That it's very unlikely that in any given situation that there'll be a clear right answer, and one has to be patient, try different things over time, and hope for the best.
Right, and you know, these families are struggling because it really does impact the whole family, and, you know, the parents are doing the best they can, and, you know, we call it the medication roller coaster, and it's very difficult because these children are very severely impaired. You know, finding stabilization is very difficult. I mean, a lot of these kids are just in and out of residential facilities, you know, hospitalized, they're homeschooled, they go from, you know, one school environment to another, so, you know, these parents are struggling, which is why I really wanted you to come on, because, you know, they need to understand what's going on. And, you know, like I said, you know, that we find these clusters, like Tourette syndrome, let's say. You find a lot of comorbidity with bipolar in Tourette syndrome, as you do with other disorders. And one of my questions actually was, is there any input from any type of work group of neurologists, since a lot of these neurobiological disorders are related to them?
It actually varies work group from work group, and there's usually some, but probably not enough. And I think one of the problems in general with the whole system is that although experts are absolutely necessary in coming up with a diagnostic system, often they have their own biases. In fact, always they have their own biases and tend to see things through their own particular way of seeing things. And I think it would be good to have the DSMs done with much wider input from various physicians of all types, primary care physicians, pediatricians, neurologists, and also to have people with expertise in school problems, in health economics, in all sorts of the larger issues that go beyond the expertise of any one expert who's likely to have spent his whole career just treating that particular problem in his own setting, in a setting that may not generalize very well to the world at large. I think to the point you were making earlier, I wish there were an answer for parents that would make things simpler. But I just think that a difficult kid is a difficult kid is a difficult kid. And you have to hope for the best that with time and treatment, things will get better, as it often does. But one of the things I'm trying to help people realize is that shoehorning the problem into a convenient category sometimes makes it worse rather than better. The difficult, seemingly unmanageable behavior is really a symptom. It's not necessarily a diagnosis. It's more like fever. And you can have fever for 150 different reasons. And similarly, you can have a kid who's causing a lot of disruption in his life and in the lives of everyone around him for lots of different reasons. If the diagnosis of bipolar helped us understand it better and provided a clear-cut treatment recommendation that was going to be almost always helpful and not harmful, then by all means, let's do it. But I don't think we have that kind of cure-all here. And what I'm worried about is that at least with some kids, the treatment may be worse than the problem, especially if it's prolonged for too long or the doses are too high. So I'm not saying that these medications aren't often very helpful with disruptive kids. Maybe in many situations, they can be absolutely wonderful and necessary. And when that's the case, they should certainly be used, but they shouldn't be used under the guise of a bipolar diagnosis that may not make sense. It should be realized that it's a symptomatic treatment the way aspirin is for fever. And then it should be used as long as it's necessary. For bipolar disorder, the tendency is to believe it needs to be used lifetime. And that's just not the case for many kids with these kinds of problems. It should be seen as more a symptom treatment rather than a treatment for a diagnosis.
Right. And I think, you know, it's important for parents to understand that these classifications that are in the DSM are not coming from, you know, it's not like a blood test. You know, it's not a diagnostic. It's nothing really that you have that's proof or evidence. And I think, you know, maybe is that your concern that, you know, do you feel that the classifications are not based on evidence? And, you know, maybe your own experience has taught you that, you know, exchanging one concept for another just brings more problems. So
I think that some of the diagnoses in the manual, there's lots and lots of evidence for, never enough, but a lot of evidence. For childhood bipolar disorder, it's not in the manual. We didn't put it there because there was so little evidence for it. So this is a case where
do you think the evidence is now?
I think it's very poor. I think it's being way over-diagnosed.
Right.
So I think that the point you made before, Marion, that there being no biological test is very important for everyone to understand, that these disorders are based on the presentation of the person, symptoms the kid has, and behaviors the kid has. There's no biological test to say someone has bipolar disorder or someone has attention deficit disorder.
Right.
And so they're defined as best we can define them, given the knowledge we have about prognosis, about family loading for the problem, about different treatments. But it's always tentative, somewhat arbitrary, and a slightly different definition could result in a dramatic change in who gets diagnosed and who not. With childhood bipolar, the diagnosis has increased by 40-fold, not because the criteria were changed in DSM-4, but because this became a very popular, sad diagnosis with a kind of false epidemic. Everyone began going to conferences and hearing about how kids were different than adults, that the developmental factors meant that chronic irritability was a precursor or a childhood manifestation of bipolar disorder. It didn't have to be cycles as an adult and so forth. And I think the field just fell in love with a concept that's just probably simply wrong and has been overused. Now, that doesn't mean that the medication may not help some of the people who have been mislabeled, because it has, just as aspirin has effects on fevers of all kinds, the medication can help irritable, disorganized, sometimes violent behavior in kids, just because it's a kind of sedative that works against excitement, whatever the cause of it. But then the individual case has to be evaluated, because the medicine itself has so many potential side effects and possible long-term effects on the brain. So you have to feel that it's very necessary to use it and to continue using it, be very careful about the dose, and be judging it more on its symptomatic effects rather than the presumption you're treating what's probably a fictitious bipolar disorder in kids.
Well, are you saying then that you really don't think that, you're not saying that there is no bipolar in children? What you're saying is that there are a lot of children that are being misdiagnosed with bipolar in children.
I think it's probably quite rare. I think it certainly exists. I've seen cases, but I think it's probably quite rare. And what happens whenever you get a fad diagnosis, or fad in anything, a fashion in anything, is that there's a bandwagon effect, and people begin seeing it everywhere, and I think that's what's happened with this. It's a kind of bandwagon effect. I think just now it's beginning to wear off, but it'll take a while before the snowball stops rolling. And for these last 20 years, it's been...
You know, I think parents really don't care what the label is. I think they want their children to be able to have a direction of treatment, to be able to receive the accommodations. These are severely impaired children. And, you know, thank God, with so much new research and findings that are going on now with the Child Bipolar Disorder Research Foundations, you know, I think that whatever they decide on now, however they decide to label these children, you know, that's going to quickly change, hopefully, as they find the pathways and the biological markers. And, you know, I think if they found...
Mary, let me interrupt there. I wouldn't be so optimistic about that. I think, again,
really?
I think it's going to take a very... One of the things we find as we learn more about the brain is how complicated it is. The brain is right. The most complicated thing in the known universe. We don't know anything in the universe that's as complicated as the brain. That there are 100 trillion connections in the brain, that the things that can go wrong are subtle and various, that there's unlikely to be a simple genetic answer for any of the psychiatric disorders, and probably not a simple answer for any of them. So that it's not as if when there's a new discovery in psychiatry, it explains most of a given problem. With schizophrenia, we can maybe explain 2% of it. But each discovery will probably only explain a tiny percentage. It won't be like a sudden breakthrough that explains all of schizophrenia. And it's like that in most of medicine. There was tremendous excitement 20 years ago with the discovery of a gene for breast cancer. But it only accounts for about 3% of breast cancer. And it's not as if we've, in the last 20 years, figured out ways to understand the rest of it. So I think medical science has a lot of potential and wonderful, wonderful tools. But the problem is that the body, and especially the brain, is so complicated that the more you discover, the more you realize how little you know. And I think that we've been constantly disappointed, expecting breakthroughs that just don't happen. And that's discouraging on one hand, but on the other hand, I think it's best to be realistic and to have realistic hope with kids especially, because many kids get better with time and with changed circumstances. So there's always reason to believe with a given kid that that kid will turn out just fine and things will get better with time, because it so often happens that way. The majority of times kids get much better with aging. On the other hand, to think that there'll be a sudden breakthrough next week that's going to explain these problems and give us a much better treatment for them, I'm really not thinking it's going to be like that. I think it's going to be decades of work, with each finding being just a tiny, tiny piece of the puzzle, and without any sudden breakthroughs.
Well, hopefully we'll get all those pieces of the puzzle put together one day. And, you know, as you said, they do get better with time. And I think that, you know, part of it maybe is the maturation and, you know, they grow up. But also I think that it's, you know, early intervention is really key. And learning how to deal with these children, how to, you know, we've had Dr. Ross Green on several times, and, you know, the collaborative problem solving, a lot of it is in the way that you relate to the child also. And, you know, the medications is a big part, but it's not all of it. You know, but whatever the case may be, these kids are severely impaired. You know, you call it bipolar, call it, you know, TDD, call it ODD, whatever you like. These children are severely impaired. And, you know, the idea of TDD, actually, at first, it was severe mood dysregulation was originally, I think, what they were going to categorize these children as. And then that was later switched to TDD. But what is the answer? Because what is the problem with broadening the criteria under child bipolar? Because really that's what it's coming down to, is where are we going to put this criteria, where are they going to put this criteria that they've now found that is in a large population of these kids? So I guess the options are either you add it to the already existing childhood bipolar under, you know, NOS, or, you know, I don't know if they could add dimensions to it, or you need to create a whole new disorder. So, you know, what is your opinion on that?
Well, I think what's happened is that the leaders in child psychiatry have become very concerned, as I've been concerned, about the excessive diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And they realize that there's nothing we can do in DSM-5, they can do in DSM-5 to change that, because this is not a problem caused by DSM-4. It's caused by the ignoring of the criteria in DSM-4. And so what they've suggested is a new disorder, which has different names, but the simplest one to remember is temporary dysregulation disorder, that would be for kids who have repeated episodes of temper tantrums three times a week for a year, and mood irritability between the episodes. The hope is that this new diagnosis would be used instead of childhood bipolar disorder. So the problem, one of the problems with childhood bipolar disorder is it implies a lifetime course. And the risk is that if a kid gets this diagnosis early in life, not only will they have the stigma of having a lifetime diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which prevents you from doing all sorts of things, including getting a pilot's license, but also they may think they need to be on medication for a lifetime when maybe they don't. And you could avoid the possibility of obesity and all the complications of that if you had a new diagnosis that didn't imply bipolar disorder. So they suggested this new proposal, this new diagnosis that would be for people who have kids who have temper problems, frequent temper tantrums three times a week or more, and who have irritable mood in between the temper tantrums. Right. The problem with this is that, as often is the case, the fix can be as bad as or worse than the solution, worse than the problem. In trying to fix a problem, sometimes your solution causes more trouble than you originally had. And the real risk of this new suggestion is that, based on almost no research, a new diagnosis will be introduced, and that this diagnosis will be used for less severely ill kids than the ones you're describing, because it's really easy to have three temper tantrums a week and irritability between those temper tantrums. You can have that without being very severely impaired. Lots of kids between the ages of 6 and 10 are like that. And the fear I would have, and others also would have, is that in introducing this attempted fix for the bipolar problem, they'll be creating a whole new problem with kids who should essentially be considered, you know, maybe normal or just oppositional, getting this new diagnosis, and with the incorrect assumption that the antipsychotic medications would be the appropriate treatment. And so this might lead to even more mislabeling and more over-treatment. So the real fix would be to just accept the fact and educate everyone about the fact that bipolar is being overdiagnosed and have it be less diagnosed, to consider these very severe problems you're describing as symptoms that need to be treated symptomatically, because we often don't have a very good way of diagnosing them within our system, to realize that kids can be changeable over time, can be responding to all sorts of environmental problems that they may be having as well, and to take a sort of watchful, waiting, stepped approach both to diagnosis and to treatment, first with watchful waiting, then with interventions that aren't likely to have the long-term consequences of medication. So everything you were saying about psychotherapy and parent training, I think that's wonderful. I think that's useful, probably useful for all kids to have experiences that may help them to learn to control their tempers and to be able to deal better with difficult, stressful situations. I have no problem at all with kids being overdiagnosed if the overdiagnosis leads to that kind of intervention. What I am very concerned about is excessive use of medication, particularly since these medications can be so very harmful.
Right, and you know, that really comes down to the discretion of the writing psychiatrist. because, you know, that's really, you know, where it ends. And the psychiatrist has to be really sure how impaired this child is. And believe me, there are a lot of severely impaired children, and it's a shame if, you know, that's the case, that this is happening, because I think by and large, these parents, the last thing they want to do is medicate the children. It is a heart-wrenching decision, and it is just causes so much anxiety in these families. And, you know, you keep mentioning the lifetime diagnosis. You know, how do you feel about the criteria being based on, or the diagnoses being based on, adult outcomes? Because there's been a lot of research done about how children that presumably had bipolar wind up having depression, unipolar, and anxiety disorders, and not bipolar. And do you think that that's weighing in, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think part of the problem is that in prematurely jumping to the conclusion that someone has bipolar disorder, one, you're giving them medication treatment they may not need. Two, the implication is that they may need that treatment for a very long time, maybe their whole lives. And three, you may be missing other ways of intervening that may be more helpful, and other conditions they may have that may be more definitive. The diagnoses are very changeable in kids in a way they're not in adults, or at least less so in adults. And the idea of, you know, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder has been made in kids 2 or 3 years old. That on the basis of the slightest amount of information, this diagnosis has been slapped on kids and they've received antipsychotic medication. That I think, as you're pointing out, it's not as stable, not as certain a diagnosis in kids. And that it's much better to be considering all the other possibilities and also realizing that you have to reevaluate the diagnosis with time. That you make a diagnosis in a six-year-old, that diagnosis may or may not be pertinent when he's 7 or 17, and that reevaluation is always useful, and particularly if things are not going well in the treatment, or not going well in his school life, or not going well in his family life, to be very flexible about diagnosis and not get stuck in thinking the categories are biblical in their import, to always have the feeling that these are very tentative categories and they have to be applied flexibly for each and every situation.
And, you know, I think another one of the main concerns that a lot of different groups and, you know, parents have been speaking about is the concern in a misdiagnosis causing the use of the wrong class of medication, and it could do more harm than good. Like, you know, stimulants and SSRIs are contradicted to be used in children with bipolar, but children that do not actually have bipolar or have a different subtype may need that medication. So, you know, it may sound very simplistic, but if kids were treated for the symptoms and not the diagnosis, I mean, wouldn't this avoid the problem? You know, and that's where the tempered dysphoric disorder is coming in, because, you know, that actually would be put into a different category, as I understand it. That wouldn't be considered a mood disorder like bipolar is. That would be considered a disruptive behavioral disorder. Is
well, I
that
think
correct?
They're seeing it as a mood disorder, but not a bipolar mood disorder, so that it wouldn't have the same implications about the use of stimulants. It might not have the same implications about the use of stimulants and the use of antidepressants. But I really think that, especially with kids, these categories are much less governing of the treatment to be given than they are with adults. So that the treatment protocols for adults with bipolar disorder are pretty clear-cut at this point. You might get some disagreement, but I mean, by and large, we have a pretty clear sense of how to proceed. Similarly, with unipolar depression in adults, I think with kids, things are much less certain, and especially since the kids you're talking about are presenting so much with conduct problems and irritability and temper dysregulation, that these things don't fit comfortably into any of the categories. And I do think, as you're suggesting, that dealing with them as more symptoms than as part of the clear-cut disorders, and symptoms that may be temporary and may be triggered by environmental problems, I think that this is a more cautious approach, and that the medications then become a kind of last resort when you really have to use them, and also to be used only for so long and in such a dose as is absolutely necessary. And again, no parent should say, okay, based on this, I'm going to take my kid off medications or reduce the medications unilaterally.
No, of course not.
Because they could get into lots of trouble with that. But on the other hand, I think it's a wise idea to be as well informed as possible, as skeptical as possible, and to give as many opinions as possible, and to keep an open mind as the kid grows up about what's appropriate at any given point in that person's life, because it can be so changeable, over time. And again, psychotherapy is very, very useful, and it's often very.
And I think it's also.
You go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, I was going to say, I think it's also very useful because I think that the reason that the explosive outbursts become so predominant in the diagnosis is because they're the most difficult to deal with, you know, for the parents, for the child, and that a lot of the secondary symptoms seem to take, you know, are on the back burner. But if they're addressed, they could probably help the whole situation. I mean, if there are sensory issues, that could absolutely be causing a lot of explosive behavior. So, you know, it's just so difficult to unravel the whole situation. And, you know, medication is absolutely needed for a lot of these kids. But, you know, these kids are very young. And, you know, as you said, you know, you need to have caution and, you know, be sure. And, you know, also I know that you have a concern about over-medicating the kids. And I just wanted to counter that, you know, play the devil's advocate. You know, do you feel that there is more of a risk of over-medicating the children than there is of children self-medicating, especially when they get into their teen years? And children that are not diagnosed, that, you know, for whatever reason, they're not diagnosed or they're misdiagnosed. You know, I feel there's really a risk, especially with ADD and you know, a lot of other impulsive disorders, that they choose to self-medicate, which isn't a good thing either.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a huge problem either way, but it's not clear that over-medicating with antipsychotics will prevent it. In some kids, it may make it worse.
Oh, no, I wasn't referring to antipsychotics. No, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Again, I don't think that there's a clear right answer, and, you know, for each parent, it's going to have to be the painful experimentation of different approaches. Each kid is, in a sense, individual and different, and there's not going to be one right answer, and in some cases there may not be an answer. But I think that by and large, if it were my kid, what I'd be doing is to try my best to learn everything possible that I could about what's known, to try my best to get different opinions, to not settle for the first opinion, to have an open mind about the things that are happening, and to realize that, you know, the kid's probably not going to have zero problems in his life, so that it's not as if we can expect any treatment to create a perfect solution. And to do my best to balance the risks of the problem itself with the risks of the treatment. And there's not going to probably be a right answer that applies to all kids, because it's going to be so individual that with some kids the medication, despite its risks, is so valuable. It's a no-brainer. We're going to go ahead and use this at least until there appears to be a developmental maturation and, you know, there's a big change in the kid's behavior. Mm-hmm. Then we'll begin to taper it. For other kids, the problems might really be tolerable, and the medication may be more dangerous than the problems. And this has to be, I think, pretty much a kid-by-kid, situation-by-situation, and year-by-year decision, because it can change with time. And my sense now is we've gone way overboard. So like 20 years ago, kids were getting very little medication. The tendency was not to use medication in children, because there have been so few studies of the use of medication in children. We didn't know the impact. What's happened in the last 20 years, partly under a blitz of drug company advertising, is a tremendous, I think, overuse of medication in kids without a clear understanding of what the implications may be. And I think what's beginning to happen now will be a balancing out with a more careful consideration of the needs of each child. If I were a parent, that's the way I'd be seeing it, that if the risks of the condition are so great, the risks of the medication are tolerable. But if the risks of the condition are not that great, even though the kid may be getting into trouble and causing trouble, I would be trying to use other techniques before resorting to the medication.
Right. I know that, you know, a lot of parents are using different techniques that are much more benign that are helping. I mean, people are using melatonin, people are using FAMs, people are using, you know, therapies. And, you know, for a very young child, of course, you know, you always try those first. I think a lot of the confusion the parents are having is, you know, they'll get an initial diagnosis of ADHD, and then, you know, they might go for a second opinion and get bipolar, and then they get OCD. You know, how important is the distinction as far as accommodations or treatments? And is the criteria that close that it's difficult for the psychiatrists to decide where the child fits?
Well, I think you bring up the issue of attention deficit disorder. 15 years ago, the rates of attention deficit disorder were about 4 or 5% of the kid population, and now it's 10%. And the use of medication has skyrocketed. There's no right answer about what percentage should be. So that I can't say, no one can say, you know, what the real rate is in the population. But when you get a doubling like this over the course of just about 15 years, and that doubling is associated with the marketing of new medications that are heavily advertised, the odds are that there's an overshoot. And whereas it's conceivable that before the diagnosis was not being made often enough, it seems very likely to me now that it's being made too often. And again, that doesn't mean that someone should take their kid off the medication, but there has to be a careful consideration with each child, given this environment where there's been such a huge increase in diagnosis and increase in use of medication over such a short period of time, accompanied by such aggressive drug company advertising, that the physicians haven't been swept away in a fad of overdiagnosis. And the problems with overdiagnosing and overtreating ADHD are not just in the kid, him or herself, but also on college campuses. The use of stimulant medications has become almost general. At least about 30% of college kids are using stimulants, often gotten from a friend who has a prescription or purchased, because these things are prescribed so much on college campuses that they're readily available for purchase for either performance enhancement or for recreational stimulation. So I think that we're just living in a culture that's gone, I think, overboard on the medication side. That doesn't mean that people don't need it, but at this point, the balance is on the side of, I think, of excessive usage. And if you're a parent, before jumping in on the use of the medication for ADHD or for bipolar, to think first about other possible alternatives. Now, if your kid has classic ADHD, absolutely classic, the medication's obviously going to be necessary. But lots of kids are getting the diagnosis now who wouldn't have gotten it 10 years ago, probably wouldn't be getting it if there hadn't been so much advertising for it. And in those less classic cases of ADHD, I would be more on the side of watchful waiting and counseling before jumping in with medication.
Right. And as you said, there are some children that have severe issues with impulsivity and focusing and executive functioning, and the medications are very, very helpful.
Absolutely,
you know,
essential.
It changes their lives. And, you know, I think that, you know, if a parent, for the parents that know what it's like to live with a child who's severely impaired with a mood or a behavioral disorder, I mean, there is a huge difference between a child with chronic temper outbursts, rages, meltdowns, and mood dysregulation than there is to the everyday child that has a temper tantrum. And, you know,
well,
those true mental
problems. I think that's the crucial distinction. I think that's the crucial issue. If someone has the problem and it's really severe, and especially if it's pretty classic and conforming to the way the condition is described, there's no argument the medication is useful.
Right.
But I think that the in ADHD, the argument gets to where the condition is less severe, and is medication needed for the less severe problems. And for the temper problems, it's not that so much. It's whether you're treating bipolar disorder or you're just treating the symptom of temper problems. It's the symptom of impulse control. And I'm saying the medication may be necessary in those situations, but let's not fool ourselves into thinking we're treating bipolar disorder. We're doing a symptomatic treatment like aspirin for fever. Let's do it as long as it's necessary, but not longer. Right. So I guess what I'm saying in general is that there are terrible problems out there that the parents are dealing with. No question about that. Right. And if there were clear-cut better solutions, that would be wonderful. But I think we have to realize at this point that there's a great deal of uncertainty in how best to deal with each individual kid, and it's always a risk-benefit analysis about what to do next without an easy answer. And as I was saying before, I don't think there's going to be an easy research answer in the next few years that's going to help a parent who has a child with that problem now. So I think a person has to sort of dig in and just do the best they can and not expect too much of themselves or necessarily too much of the kid. You can just do the best you can under these difficult circumstances.
Right. And, you know, because it's you know, as I said, our audience, you know, unfortunately, these children are not on the mild end of anything. You know, I guess that's why they come to us and why they listen to us. So we have a lot of children that are diagnosed with bipolar that are severely, severely impaired in and out of hospitals. And, you know, these families are struggling. And, you know, people have to understand that, you know, bipolar is not a vogue, you know, diagnosis. It is, you know, a potentially fatal illness, and these families are struggling. You know, as they say about autism, you know, just these kids, they're all so different. You know, there's a saying about autism, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. And I know the parents feel that way about these children with mental illness. They're just so very different.
Well, my hearts go out to the parents, and I've been lucky with my kids, but certainly I've been very close to any number of friends and the heartbreak that they've experienced over the raising of their kids. The one good thing in my experience has been that so many hopeless situations turned out just fine with time, that time is often the best hope, and patience and being able to get through the tough times is often rewarded with a much, much improved situation once the kid outgrows the problem. But there's no doubt that the problems are terrible. The question is, will the solution make them better or will the solution make them worse? And I guess what I'm saying is I don't see the widespread use of bipolar disorder as a useful solution, and that with the antipsychotics, I think they have their place, but that they're being overused. It's tough. It's tough being a parent.
I'm going to hope that you're wrong. I'm going to hope that, you know, that there will be at least some direction and some, you know, some more definitive research coming out. Maybe not tomorrow, but, you know, hopefully soon enough.
I'll tell you the problem. Yeah, when DSM-3 was published in 1980, there was tremendous excitement in our field because we had, for the first time, a diagnostic system where you could get agreement amongst the different people seeing a patient about what the diagnosis was. And the amount of money that's been devoted to psychiatric research has been absolutely enormous in the last 30 years. It's been a wonderful thing, and we've learned a tremendous amount about how the brain works. It's been an absolute revolution. And the techniques are amazingly powerful. No one could have dreamed 30 years ago that we'd be able to do what we can do now with genetics or with imaging of the brain or with studying how an individual neuron works. We know a tremendous amount about how the brain works now in a way that no one could have dreamed of. However, what we found is that the psychopathology, the problems in how the brain works, are remarkably heterogeneous. They're remarkably specific to individual people rather than explaining why all the people get the problem. That there's a line in a book by Tolstoy that all normal families are normal in the same way and every abnormal family is abnormal in its own way. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And it's like that with the brain. In order to have normal functioning, you have to do a whole lot of things just right. And we're learning a lot about normal functioning. But so many different things can go wrong that there aren't, I think, going to be really simple answers. And for the last 30 years, people have been searching really hard for quick answers. And with a remarkable amount of effort by remarkably smart people, we found out a great deal about normal brain functioning and remarkably little about what causes the different forms of difficulty in mental disorder. And I think it's probably better in life to be realistic than hopeful, if the hopefulness is going to just be disappointed. I think that for any parent with a kid, it's much more likely that time is going to be on their side and the kid will get better with time and with love and with counseling and with medication, than to expect that there's going to be a breakthrough from psychiatry that's going to solve the problem before that kid grows up.
All right. You know, I'd like to read a quote of yours. You said, "We are at the epicycle stage of psychiatry, where astronomy was before Copernicus and biology before Darwin. Our inelegant and complex current descriptive system will undoubtedly be replaced by simpler, more elegant models." What do you see or hope for the future for the diagnostic guideline manuals?
Well, I think the biggest hope right now is a project that the National Institute of Mental Health has started, trying to bring together their enormous resources to figure out what are the underlying neural networks for fairly simple behaviors. So like violence might be one of them. Wouldn't it be nice if we understood the brain connections involved with violent behavior? And it may be that with the enormous resources of NIMH and picking fairly simple targets, fear, violence, aspects of cognitive functioning, depression, that we may be able to get some answers that will be helpful. But even the people doing this see this as a project for decades. I think the people in the field, all of us, were much more optimistic about 15 or 20 years ago that there'd be quick answers than we are now, because we just find out that even though we get more and more powerful tools and wonderful results and tremendous deep understanding, the target keeps receding. The more we know, the more we realize that we don't know. So I would see this as a project for decades rather than for years.
Okay, well, hopefully, the NIMH, actually they're my guest next week. I have Susan Sweeto coming on, which I'm thrilled. They'll start identifying the pathways, and start leading into a direction. So I thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Great best of luck to any parent who has a kid who's difficult. The great thing to know is that most kids get, by far the majority of kids get much less difficult, and the problems get much more manageable as time goes on, and that it's unpredictable that someone may seem to present hopeless challenges now but may turn out to be a very solid citizen in the future. And I would never give up hope on a kid.
Never give up hope. Well, thank you again. As I said, I'm so grateful that you came. You know, I think the parents need the information.
Good. Thank you for inviting me.
As I end the show. Oh, anytime. Tomorrow, actually, I will be having a chat on the importance of constructing a lifestyle that suits your child's disorder, be it academic placement, family outings, career choices, setting goals that are attainable. So that's a small chat I'm going to be having on our tweet chat tomorrow morning. And as we end the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Coffee Crunch.